Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Steve Garcia. Steve is the co-founder of the Institute for Contemporary Leadership. He is also a managing partner at Contemporary Leadership Advisors. He is the co-author of the book, The End of Leadership as We Know It, and he is on a mission with his partners to guide the future of leadership. And I'm really excited to get into this conversation with Steve as he explains to us why, in many ways, leadership, as we have been classically educated, trained, and instructed, is over. It doesn't necessarily work that way anymore. So he's going to talk us through how we can unlock the power of our hidden network, why we should treat strategy as a hypothesis, how to capitalize on our 3 degrees of influence, and how, as leaders, we can function more successfully in today's high-fast, quick-changing environment. I'm so excited to share this conversation with you all today. Thank you so much for being here once again. Before we do, let's take a quick moment to thank our sponsors. First, we have Humantel. If you have not, please head over to humantel.com. If you've ever thought about developing the skill set to be able to understand what people are likely thinking and feeling at any moment in time, by recognizing shifts in their emotion through their facial expressions and nonverbal communication, then I highly recommend you head over to humantel.com, read their research, understand the science behind their background, and then choose the online training that's best for you. And when you choose it, enter the code INCLASIVE25 for 25% off your educational experience. I highly recommend it. I've done it all myself. It's over there at humantel.com. For the professional interviewers, please head over to certifiedinterviewer.com to get all your questions answered about the International Association of Interviewers. Who should apply for membership? What does it take to qualify for membership? What are the educational opportunities online and in person? What are the investigator resources that are available there? Networking opportunities, so much more. It's also where you can learn about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What does it take to qualify? How do you earn the designation? What could it mean for you and your career moving forward as you maintain the designation? All of those questions and more will be answered at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please check out inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, business development professionals, HR teams, and more, in order to help them apply the strategic observation and persuasive communication skills necessary to encourage people to be open and honest during their high-value conversations. All of that and more at inquasive.com. Once again, thank you all for being here week after week. We appreciate you coming back this week. And now, without further ado, I introduce to you Steve Garcia. Good morning, Steve. It is great to see you. Thank you so much for being here today. How are you?
I'm doing well, Michael. Thank you. It's lovely to be here. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to chat with you.
Well, I appreciate you sharing the time, man. Well, is it burying the lead? I don't know how you say it, but you and I had a chance to meet in New York City not too long ago when we both presented at the same event. And I really appreciated your approach and what you had to share. And now I'm thankful to have the opportunity to be selfish and dive in deeper with the questions I couldn't ask that day.
Well, I'll ask away. I'm an open book, so I'll answer whatever you got. And I really enjoyed that session as well. And likewise, I really appreciated hearing your take. So that was a lot of fun. And hopefully we get the chance to do it again sometime.
I look forward to it. That would be awesome. So to dive in, I figured, why not start with the title of your book, which honestly, from an interviewer standpoint, kind of feels like a lazy place to ask the first question. But I feel like it's a great way to open up the conversation. So I might screw this up a little bit. If I do, please correct me. The title of your book is essentially leadership has changed the way we know it, or leadership the way, I'm sorry, leadership the way we know it has changed forever. That's the title of the book. I don't want to insult you. Did I get that right?
Well, it's the very close. So
did insult you. I apologize.
So you got the main point. The title is The End of Leadership as We Know It.
That's what it is.
And that title, actually, I got to give credit to my co-author, Dan Fisher, because that was his idea. And the premise behind it is really kind of two things driving that. One was, what caused us to write the book is in our work with executives, we have found that many of them are very, very frustrated. The things that worked well for them in the past, what they learned in business school, the advice they got from their mentors, all that great stuff, is less effective in a sort of, much faster paced, more complex business environment that we find ourselves in today. So we're being a little provocative with that title, but the idea was to be effective as a leader, to thrive today, you have to do things differently. So in effect, what, we've moved to sort of hit a phase transition, right? Which requires new behaviors, new ways of showing up. And so we're saying the old way of doing things has sort of been put to bed, and it's time to sort of embrace a new approach. And so that's where the end of leadership as we know it came from. And then the other thing was, Dan and I are both big R. Young fans. We were both in college. It tells you how old we were, you know, back when those guys were just on like college radio. And so we thought it was a nice play on the end of the world as we know it. So that was the other angle. But that was the genesis for the title.
Well, thank you for getting that song stuck in my head for at least the remainder of this conversation, right, if not the remainder of the day. As soon as you said REM fan, it started playing in my mind. So I guess we're close to the same age and we're in college around the same time. And I actually don't think the title of the book is that provocative. I mean, I guess it's a little bit provocative because of the declarative statement. But when you think about it, we're always in that cycle and things are always changing. And there's probably not that clear, like, dividing line where here is the day where everything doesn't work anymore. There's some gray space in between and it carries over. But how has effective leadership essentially changed in the current business operational environment?
So I think it helps to kind of just sort of share some examples. I think in a slower paced environment, you can kind of figure out what works, and then you can adopt a really sort of top down command and control, model, right? Because there's time for leaders to figure things out and then communicate that, cascade it down the hierarchy. And everyone knows what their marching orders are, and they can go off and they can execute based on those marching orders. And because the world's not changing very fast, like what they've been instructed to do, if they do it well, will create value. Because leaders are able to figure out cause and effect. They can predict outcomes over time. They know if you do, X, Y, and Z, then the following things are going to happen. And so I think for a long time, that sort of top-down command and control approach worked, remarkably well. And we created a lot of value for, investors and stakeholders and employees and customers and everyone else. I think in a world where, new opportunities and threats now appear literally overnight, like the world has become so interconnected that, you can do something here and it has this big, ripple cascade effect on everything else. So it's really hard to understand what causes what or what's going to happen over time. And so in that world, the danger is if you give people instructions, right, by the time they actually carry those instructions out, they're no longer applicable, right? And so we spend time checking the box, trying to get things done, but they're less relevant than we thought. And so I think, that means leaders need to show up and sort of behave in different ways, right? I think they need to recognize that they don't have all the answers, and they need to sort of create a system or environment where those answers, well, one where they can be far more adaptive, the organization as a whole can be far more adaptive and can sort of recognize changes in the external market and then can pivot and take advantage of those changes. And that just requires, again, that they do things a little bit differently than they had in the past.
In just a second, I'd love to ask you about what some of those different things are. Yeah. But as I was listening to you go through that, I was the concept that kept going through my brain was, if we can't tell people what to do, get them good at doing that, and just have them follow instructions because the environment changed too fast. So, you might be doing the right thing for 3 days ago, but it's not the right thing today. Then does that mean it is now more important to teach people how to think or how to problem solve than it is to tell people what to do?
I think, Yeah, absolutely, that's true. And interestingly, a lot of the development work we do now with leaders is around that very thing, Michael. So I think you're spot on, right? People want to understand. It's funny. Like we'll get, the leaders at the top of the house are always like, I want my folks to take greater ownership. I want them to act like owners and, you know, be empowered. And why are they not stepping up, right? Like, and then the folks lower down the organization are always like, I want those guys, those folks to, be willing to let up some control, right? And to, ask me to do more and not feel the need to like double check everything and make all the decisions on their own, right? So it's really a two-way street. I think both parties, I mean, it's easy to sort of point the finger at the other folks, right? But I think both of those groups need to sort of change how they work and how they interact with one another in order for the system to work.
Yeah, I agree. And I always kind of chuckle. I try to chuckle only to myself anytime I'm working with somebody and I hear them say, I want my people to think and operate like owners, like leaders. Okay, that's great to say. And it's a wonderful concept. But in all likelihood, the leader I'm speaking with has been educated, has been mentored, has been trained, has the experience
to, a lot of it, yeah,
how to think and operate that way. The people who they want to think and operate that way don't have the education, don't have the mentoring, don't have the experience. So that's like saying, you know what, Mike, I would really like you to speak Portuguese.
That's a great example.
Fun to me, but I don't know how.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think you have to be, it's easy to say, right? And certainly, I think when leaders are willing to let up some control, they create space for other people to, in fact, step up, right? But, you don't want to ask folks to do things they can't do, right? And so you really want to sort of tune or adapt the request to, you know, what exactly as you describe, right? The competence of the folks that you're engaging, interacting with, right? So I think you have to be thoughtful about that, to make sure that you, are willing to, you know, empower those around you, but also not to, you know, expect things that, you know, they're going to be unable to deliver, because that's just going to make everyone happy.
Yeah. It's now I'm getting angrier because somebody is meeting, for lack of a better word, unfair or unreasonable expectations.
Yeah.
And I've placed on them.
Yeah.
So if we're going to ask somebody to think like an owner, to think like a leader, giving them the space to fail and learn and not be embarrassed about it, I would imagine is one side of the coin. And then the other side of the coin is actually teach them how to do it. And if we can't teach them directly, provide them access to the resources, the mentors, the support, so they can learn along the way.
Yeah. Yeah. I think being really clear about the expectations, I think a lot of times, one challenge we see is leaders think they've communicated clear expectations, but folks on the other end, that happens all the time with interactions, right? We think people understand what we're saying, but we're not communicating well, or they're hearing it differently. So, right. So being really explicit about what the ask is. And then to your point, making sure people have the support that they need, right? Both the sort of, expertise, right? The tools, the resources to get it done. And that's a big dance, right? It's both parties have to be interacting with each other productively for that to happen, which is, what keeps, me and you and other folks sort of actively engaged is that, because that's not always easy to do. And sometimes people need sort of counsel or outside perspective to make it happen.
That's a very good point. And I think that concept ties back into what leaders have to do differently now, how we have to kind of show up differently and behave differently. And a thought that I saw as I was getting prepared for this interview that I really, really appreciated is overcoming or going beyond some of the traps of conventional wisdom. I think that in many ways, conventional wisdom is conventional for a reason. The fundamentals are fundamentals for a reason. But as time evolves and the dynamics of the environment change and the situation change, just putting on the blinders to conventional wisdom creates way more problems than it solves. So I would love to just open the floor and ask you to please walk us through how can we overcome some of these traps of conventional wisdom to begin showing up and behaving the way we need to in today's environment?
So yeah, there's a bunch, and it makes sense because we all like to make things easier on ourselves, right? And so if we can create algorithms or patterns or habits that we can consistently apply that are going to make things simpler and easier, then hey, by all means, that sounds fantastic. Who wouldn't want to take advantage of that? But as you point out, those can also, in stable environments where the world doesn't change that easy and you know something's going to be, is going to work, then that's easier to do. But today, I think, you know, because things change so quickly, what worked last Tuesday might not work, you know, next Thursday, right? So like, you know, one of the big ones that we see a lot is sort of this idea of upfront strategic planning, right? So people think, oh, we need to set aside time at the start of the year to really think carefully around what our strategy is going to be. And then we can take that strategy and we can figure out, break it into pieces and say, hey, you go do this and you go do this, and you go do this. And then those folks are going to go off and they're going to do their part really well. And then at the end of the year, we can look and say, okay, did you do what you said you were going to do? And we can reward people based on their execution of that strategy and the value they created, right? Again, in a stable, slower paced environment, that works great because you can kind of predict what's going to happen and you can understand cause and effect. In a much faster environment, right? The strategy could fall from the sky in a stone tablet, be the perfect strategy, right? But for that moment in time, but in 3 months, who knows, right? So this idea of letting go of you know, doing your strategy at the beginning and then going and executing, and instead integrating strategy and execution into this like continual cycle where you're treating strategy as a hypothesis that you refine through execution on an ongoing basis, using tools like objectives and key results, OKRs, or you know, other, you know, similar methods, right? So you're really focusing on how do we create value, right? And what do we need to do to increase that value? And then you're looking back over the last, you know, 2 weeks, 30 days, 45 days, whatever it is, to test, did we create the value we thought we would? Right. So is our strategy working or not? And then if not, hey, we're going to pivot and try something different. Right. So you sort of move toward what works and away from what doesn't work. So, you know, we like to call that strategic doing and versus sort of upfront strategic planning. And that would be one example. Right. Because in that way, you're constantly checking to see, am I moving the needle? Am I having the effect I want to have? Right. Is the work that I'm doing creating value and working the way that I would anticipate, as opposed to waiting till year end and looking back, and you might have done all the things you might have completed all the activities, right, that you said you thought you wanted to, but did you actually create value? And I think that's one example where, you know, we like to say that the conventional wisdom might not apply going forward. I think another big example would be from, you know, all organizations these days are really trying to sort of transform how they operate. Right. So a big part of that is change management and this idea that you need to overcome resistance to change. Right. I think if you ask most leaders, you know, they would say people tend to be resistant to change because, like, you know, they've read that in textbooks. They learned that in school. I think we would argue that, you know, people aren't resistant to change. They respond to change. Right. And when you treat resistance as this, when you treat resistance as being something that automatically results from any kind of change, then I can lay any, like, say you and I work together, Mike, and I want to do something different, right? And you disagree. I can say, oh, well, you know, Michael, he's just, you know, he's resistant to change like everyone else, right? So my job then becomes to sort of squash that, overcome that, as opposed to actually listen to what it is that you have to say, right? Because you might have some really valid points. you know what, there's a better way to do this. This isn't going to work because X, Y, and Z. Have you thought about this? Right. So when we think about it as resistance to change, we can kind of just dismiss it, right? Versus when we actually pause to look at it, maybe we can learn something about how to, do it better based on the insight that you and others provide, right? So this whole idea of like, resistance is futile. We're gonna use change management to kind of squash that, I think, is another example where conventional wisdom just doesn't pan out in today's world.
I love both examples. I think that concept of strategic doing is fantastic. I really love what you're saying about respond versus resist to change, because I couldn't agree more that it's very easy for us to create our own narrative in advance and then immediately observe for the first indication that validates our expectation, cast all blame and responsibility onto somebody else, which then validates ourselves to begin with, and we just march on with whatever we wanted. And if we stop and think about it, yes, people do respond to change. So how I prepare, how I communicate, how I follow up, how I tie into the necessary change to their preferred outcomes and processes and all these things now play a huge role. So I think that in and of itself is an enormous paradigm or psychology shift to understand that they're not just going to automatically resist it. They're going to respond based on how they're presented with it.
So then the onus is on both of us. It's not just on, hey, your resistance or your wrong, right? I have a role to play, right, in that, in your response as well. How do I want to show up to make sure that that response is as positive as it can be? And it doesn't mean that you're always going to like it, right? It doesn't mean that leaders don't sometimes have to say, hey, this is the way it's going to be, right? But it does mean that they at least need to stop and consider, right, as opposed to just sort of, getting in their head at the start, this is the right answer, and then just proceeding, kind of squash anything that gets in the way.
For sure. And I feel like sometimes there are likely legitimate crisis, not perceived crisis, but legitimate crisis situations where a leader has to step up and say, right or wrong, this is the way we'll do it, and we'll figure out after. Because just right now, there's a legit crisis. There's not time to work through it. But my guess is those situations happen far fewer than people.
Exactly. Right. Like in CPR, the first thing they train you on is like, you tell someone, hey, you go get the defibrillator, right? Like that's not a time to have a big discussion around like something. You need to be directive, right? But I think that's that. Yes, certainly that is sometimes the case, but it's not the case as often as we might think. Right. And when we treat every instance as that, then we disengage a lot of people. And at the end of the day, we're not going to get the results that we want.
Yeah, it's, again, I agree completely. And if we treat every situation like it is a crisis, it's a level 10, whatever you want to call it, then there's no way for people to balance priorities, to understand emotions, how much effort should I put into this, should I not? Because it's always crisis mode, full attention. So there's no opportunity for me to escalate or de-escalate or to calm people down or to change perspective, because it's always just full throttle all the time. And people, it's sensory overload. Not only can they disconnect, they just go numb and they can become paralyzed.
Yeah, I think that's really true. It's exhausting. And we see that's why employees get burned out. And that's why leaders feel really stressed, right? Because that's just an exhausting place to be. No one wants to be in that situation.
No, I love both of those. We certainly don't need to go through every one. Are there a few other conventional wisdom traps that you think are important for people to recognize and try to keep their legs out of?
I think one of them is, historically, leaders have been instructed like, they need to always be the one like in control, right? And so showing any kind of vulnerability is, is going to, undermine their authority, right? And so, and also people who tend to be, move up in the hierarchy, they're kind of used to being right, right? Like and so it's sort of their self-identity is built around the fact that they know the answer, right? Mm-hmm. It's a great article by Chris Argyris around, it's difficult to teach smart people how to learn because their identity is based on being right. And it's threatening. But I think no individual can be right. No one's ever right all the time to begin with, but I think it's a lot harder today than it was in the past because your experience and no one can be expert enough, and your experience is less relevant when things are constantly shifting. There's a great story. There's a gentleman, a client and a friend named David Chang, who was sent to Shanghai to lead a manufacturing facility for a large global pharmaceutical firm. And David was, it was his first time, he spoke Chinese, but it was his first time working in China. He arrived at the plant and, he was met with this audience of like 800 people, enthusiastically clapping. And he started speaking and, everyone was sort of nodding in agreement with what he said. And what he realized over several weeks was it really didn't matter what he said, people would agree. And the problem with that was his background was in development, not in manufacturing. And he was an expert in, small, large molecules. And so he started feeling really desperate that he, cause he didn't have the answers and people were expecting him to. And so he started saying, I don't know, when asked. And he said, I don't know, so many times that his HR lead pulled him aside and said, hey, David, you might want to tone that down because, people are going to lose confidence in you. But he felt like he didn't have, he couldn't fake it till he make it. He said, this wasn't Silicon Valley and it wasn't an option for me. And what happened over time is when he sort of stepped back, it forced other people to step up. And so he would ask everyone at the table, hey, what is your opinion on this? And they start to see that their opinions really mattered. And it changed the culture of the whole plant, and their engagement scores and their productivity went through the roof. And he ended up getting pulled back to, or called back to Switzerland to sort of explain what he had done, because it was a transformation, that they'd never seen before. And I think it's a great example of when you're willing to sort of share when you don't know and be vulnerable, it can actually have, a huge impact. But again, I think that's counter to what a lot of us are led to believe. That can lead to poor decisions being made. And again, people feeling stressed and burnt out.
Yeah, it's so many good points there. I can't help but let my mind wander past the REM song that's still stuck in my head and just picture what that conversation in Switzerland looked like. So, David, what did you do? I just said, I don't know. Yeah. But what did you do? What processes? I just said, I don't know. But how did you develop the I just said, I don't know. Like they're going for this huge, like, what is this giant strategy you put in place? Like, dude, I just said, I don't know. And everybody else stepped up. Sometimes it can be, I know it's not simple, but sometimes it can be that simple.
Well, it sounds simple, but it's also a huge mindset shift, right? Like, I think, again, if you're an executive and you've been trained and it's tough to sort of open up and be honest when you aren't sure. That can be difficult.
It's super difficult. There's no doubt about that. And I think especially as you said, to go back to people whose identity is being right, being in charge, being in control. Yeah. And thankfully coming from the investigative interviewing background, especially in cases with multiple suspects and no evidence, who'd already been interviewed, my teammates and I had to learn really quick that the best way to keep control is to give up control. The more I try to force control of the situation, the less I'm going to have. So the sooner I can make the other person feel like they're in control, the more successful I can be. But that was a really unique operating environment. Most people don't have that. And I was thinking when I was listening to that story as well, and you probably have better arms around the research than I do. So here I go opening my mouth without the research in front of me. But it also reminds me of the dawn of, is it cockpit management, where it was something that, and here's where I'm going to get the numbers wrong probably, but something like 80% of consumer airline accidents prior to 1980, whatever, can be directly traced back to lack of communication in the cockpit. Like somebody else saw the problem, But the culture in the airline industry was the pilot has complete control. So there's all these audio recordings of people saying, like, you might want to check the gas. You might want to check the altitude. You might want to listen to air traffic control. Or not saying anything at all right before the plane hits a mountain, runs out of gas, smashes into another plane.
It's a great example, Mike.
So it's that. Go ahead.
No, it's a great example. And the stakes in that instance is like couldn't be higher. Like you're flying right towards the mountain, right? And people can still be hesitant to speak up. And, you know, so I think it's incumbent. Now, I think people have to be courageous sometimes, and they need to sort of step into that space and share their thoughts. But also the leader needs to create an environment where that's okay. Right. And where, you know, and when they say, I don't know, or they admit their own shortcomings, that creates a lot of space for other people to share their expertise and be like, hey, you might want to steer left because the mountain's right, you know, right in front of us.
Yeah. Or steer left, damn it.
Yeah.
We're going to hit the mountain.
Depending on how close you are. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Right. So I think that, yeah, that's another. Yes. Absolutely. And I think there's a great example from the Challenger disaster, where there were folks who felt strongly that there was a problem and had difficulty raising it. And, you know, look what happened. So there's way too many examples like that.
And for people that missed the REM and now the Challenger reference, that's the space shuttle that exploded upon reentry, because I think it was one of like the heat panels, right? Failed. Was that the reason for that? Or was that the next one?
I don't, it's a good question. I should know. I don't know, but I'll go look it up. But I was someone who came and sort of shared the story with us. And I remember what I walked away with was, wow, exactly what you point out, right? Like the people who actually knew were unable to communicate their concern in an effective way. And it led to this disaster that didn't have to happen.
Yeah. I guess one of the scientists or somebody figured out that there was an issue. And to your point from before, yes, sometimes we all need to be courageous, but I do think it is also fair to put that responsibility on the leaders to do what you said. Occasionally admit you don't know, admit your shortcomings, admit you made a mistake, put yourself out there, because in many ways, that's leading by example. If I just tell you it's okay to give me critical feedback, I'm not so sure it is, because at no point previously in my life has it ever really been. But now if I'm actually critiquing myself openly in front of everybody, then I'm creating that chance for people to follow suit and share what I need to know.
Yeah, it definitely, you're leading by example, as you point out, and you're building trust, right?
Yeah.
Because one of the ways you build trust is by, you know, sharing vulnerability, right? Then other people recognize, hey, listen, this person trusts that I'm not going to, you know, take advantage of them, right? So I think that's another thing. Yeah, I think it's another sort of conventional view of leadership that, you know, again, does not work as well as it used to in today's workplace.
Yeah, for certain. You mentioned building trust. And so I'm going to use that to maybe not build a bridge, but to take a leap. Because when I saw you recently, you talked a lot about harnessing the power of our networks. And selfishly for me, to be honest, that's not something I really do a great job of. You probably similar to yourself, you put me in front of a room and I'm happy to open up and be engaged and do all those things. But at least speaking only for me, you take me out of that environment and I'm probably the guy that's hanging out in the back of the room, drinking the Guinness, watching everybody else, not necessarily being engaged. So when I was thinking about leveraging relationships, which are built on trust to harness the power of the network, I really wasn't thinking about it in many of the ways that you shared and you presented. So if you don't mind me asking a broad question to start, what are some of the biggest opportunities we have to unlock the power of our networks that we often don't realize or recognize?
Yeah. It's a good question. I think one is to appreciate the importance of the network, which I think a lot of people don't, right? You can actually, leadership is itself a relational concept, right? You can't be a leader unless there's a corresponding follower, right? So we tend to think about leadership as this set of competencies or this set of capabilities, right? Or traits. Some may say that we're born with it. Some may say we can develop it. But we tend to think about it as something that's personal to the individual, skills associated with the individual, right? But the reality is leadership is not a set of individual characteristics. Leadership is a relationship between two people, right? One person needs to show followership and be willing to be led by the person. The other person needs to show leadership, right? So it's really a relational construct in and of itself. I think, and so by definition, our effectiveness as a leader is based in how many of those relationships do we have, right? And how many of those folks are related to others, right? So there's all sorts of evidence that shows that I not only affect, if you and I have a relationship, right? My behavior doesn't only affect you, it affects the people that you're connected with, and it affects the people that they're connected with. So people like 3 degrees away, people I might not even know, right? I can influence based on sort of how I, the decisions I make and how I show up. So understanding that your impact as a leader is directly tied to sort of your network and your position in that network, right? I think is really important. And when you ask most people, hey, here's an opportunity for you to get better at these technical skills, or here's an opportunity for you to get better at sort of, understanding and building, your socio-emotional intelligence, you can build your network. Most will choose the tactical skills because they don't appreciate the importance of what they perceive as being sort of softer capabilities. So one is, I think, just making it really clear. And in our own research, we find that your network that you have is like 5 times more predictive of your performance than all sorts of personal characteristics, right? Including your, experience, your education, a bunch of stuff. So then the question becomes, okay, how can you leverage that, right? What can you do to build that? And I think for a lot of people, they sort of get disheartened by it because they think they have to be extroverts and they need to be out there, never eat lunch alone, constantly reaching out. But I think that you can build a relationship. Introverts are great at building relationships because they tend to be more focused on the values, and they're really curious and interested in the other person. So it's not just surface level. They can go deeper. And I think a lot of relationships are just built one-on-one in those intimate moments, right? So you don't have to be the guy, the person's handing out business cards. I guess business cards, back when in the old days, but you don't need to be emailing everyone every single day, right? You need to just be reaching out to the people who are either close to or you want to be close to. And you can just ask them questions about what's important to them. What do they care about? And that can go a long way toward, enhancing your network. People want to feel that others care about them. They want to feel that others are interested in them. And so, really simple steps like that can have a big impact.
I very much appreciate you highlighting the introvert's impact in ways to have a genuine conversation with people, reaching out to people you do care about, you want to care about, showing interest in them. I think that's very impactful. And also thinking back to what you said about leaders really leveraging their network to progress in their career, I'm sure plenty of people listening can think back to leaders that they've met or worked with in the past that seem to socially navigate their way to a certain position. And then once they got there, all of a sudden it became clear that maybe they didn't have what it took to lead at that level, but they did a masterful job navigating their network to get them that far. So there's certainly plenty of evidence of that out there. But you said something, now I'm cheating because I saw you talk about this previously, but you said something in there that I want to go back to. You talked about our position in our network. Yep. And that doesn't necessarily mean your job title, but you showed, I mean, we can't pull them up here, but you showed some great kind of graphic illustrations of where people are positioned in that network and what that could mean for them. I would be thrilled if you could please dive into a little bit of what does position in the network mean and how can we work to put ourselves in the right positions?
Yeah, it's a really good point, because different, we call them network structures, but different types of networks. So the shape of your network has a really big impact on, you know, what you can and can't do, right? And I think I used the analogy of like the graphite and the diamond in the in the talk, where, you know, both are made entirely of carbon, right? But, you know, diamond, like brilliant, hard, transparent, carbon is like dull, soft, opaque. So they're radically different, right? But they're both made entirely the same of the same thing. So how is that possible? And of course, the answer is it's because how those carbon atoms are connected to one another, right? And so in diamond, it's like this tetrahedron, you know, pattern, which creates like super strong bonds. And in graphite, it's in these sheets that slough off, right? So what that suggests is that the network of connections can have a really huge impact on the outcomes, right? And, you know, we all work in a giant web of connections, right? We're all in organizations that are, you know, basically fueled by people's interactions, right? To get anything done today, you got to work with someone, right? And so the shape of your network, right? Like, are you connected to people? Like you pointed out, hey, there's folks who, you know, maybe move up the hierarchy, but they're just because they're managing up, right? They're sort of, and you know, that's a network shape, right? Where, you're, you know, all of your connections are sort of, you know, vertical in the organization to people who are superior to you, right? Other people might have connections that are really tight knit in their specific department, right? So super cohesive, everyone knows one another. Everyone, you know, trusts one another. Things don't fall through the cracks. You don't step on each other's toes. Those groups are really great at executing and getting things done. Other people might have networks where they don't have a lot of really close-knit relationships with people in the same department, but they're connected to people in lots of different departments. And those folks are not connected to one another, right? So they've got all these diverse, non-redundant connections to people in different domains. And those folks, you know, the research shows, are fantastic at coming up with new ideas because they can like connect things in new ways, right? They can take information from here and information from here and combine it and come up with something that no one's ever thought of. It's kind of like why, you know, the folks at the edge of the organization, like, you know, the sales folks or the people who are interacting with customers tend to be the ones who have kind of cool, new, innovative ideas, right? But they struggle to actually make it happen because they're not connected back to head. They don't have a tight knit group within headquarters, right? And the folks in the headquarters, they can get stuff done, but it's like a big echo chamber where they just keep coming up with the same ideas over and over again, right? And so you really want a network shape that is like really tight knit with sort of your immediate peers and the folks you work with closely in your department. But then you need to have connections that are external to people with different types of expertise and different experience, because that's where you're going to get new insight, new novel information that you can use to create new stuff in new ways.
So in your experience, and I love the illustration in the comparison of the structures, in your experience, are there techniques or opportunities for people to start to build that type of network structure as opposed to just sort of finding themselves with who they've always found themselves with?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. Yeah, absolutely, right? So one, I think, is one is sometimes people are worried about trying to build relationships because they're worried about what am I going to say, right? And I would say, instead of thinking about what you want to say, think about what you want to ask. Because, you know, people respond really well to open-ended questions. And the research shows that follow-up questions are even more impactful in terms of building the relationship, right? When I ask you, you know, about yourself, right, that makes you feel good. That makes you feel understood and heard. And when I follow up and say, hey, tell me more about that, or like whatever, like that's right. So switching from what am I going to say to what am I going to ask, I think is one way. Another is, you know, the two things that really drive the formation of connections. One is proximity. Are you in the same space, right? And that can be physical space. Like we can be at the event that you and I were recently at, Michael, which is what sort of, you know, was the opportunity to create this connection, right? Or it can be virtual space, like we are now in this virtual setting, right? But putting yourself in the same virtual or physical space. So think about who you want to be connected with and make sure that you're, you know, you've got proximity to those folks one way or the other. The second thing is, like, what, when you first meet someone, you're always like, hey, you know, where'd you go to school? Or, you know, you have kids? Or, you know, what do you do for a living? Like, where do you live, right? You're looking for points of commonality to build the connection. So establishing, so you might not have anything in common with someone, but you can try and figure out if maybe you do, it's just sort of at a deeper level, right? Like you like comic books or you like Marvel movies or, you know, whatever, right? So finding what you have in common, I think, is real important. And then as a manager, if you want to get, say, you know, you and I work for an organization and our boss, Sue, she wants you and I to work more closely together, right? We might have nothing in common, right? But if she says, hey, I'm going to give you guys a shared objective, right? Or I'm going to, you know, so you can, she can create commonality for us in that regard. So I would say, you know, think about what you can ask versus what you want to say. Put yourself in the same space and look for commonality or create commonality, right? Those are probably three of the best ways to build relationships.
I love that. Create the proximity, which I do feel like in many ways is easier to do now than it was.
Oh, so, yeah.
Through social media and connections and being able to, let's say whatever, there was somebody that you wanted to meet. And so you look through my LinkedIn connections and figure out that, okay, we're connected. Well, there you go. Now you're one degree of Kevin Bacon away from an introduction, whether I really know them or not. You know, you and I have spent the time together. I'm happy to make that introduction. So it's easier. And then I think creating that commonality, I do believe, and this is my bias, is easier than a lot of people think it is, because it's very easy on the surface to say, well, I don't know if I have anything in common with that person. Or, but when you think about the universality of the human experience, brother, we got something in common with everybody. Let's not overthink it.
No, I think that is really true. And, you know, a lot of the world today like seeks to like, you know, divide, right? But I think, you know, you put two people, it's hard to hate face to face, right? Like when people, once they sort of sit down across the table from one another, you can find things you've got in common. Because as you point out, we're all humans. We all have that experience. And yeah, that's universal, right? The other thing I'd say is that you know, people tend to think social capital, which is like the value that comes from our relationships. It's not like other forms of capital, right? It actually, the more you use it, the more it grows. And a great example of this is actually Thomas Jefferson, who he realized this, and he had a political rival. And so he asked that rival to borrow a book. And when the rival said, sure, yeah, you can borrow this book, right? But that's that simple request for the favor, right? Increased the likelihood. I mean, Jefferson knew that actually increased the likelihood that rival would, you know, from then on be more likely to follow through and you know, support Jefferson. And so he ended up turning this guy from like a political foe to a political ally just by starting with asking for this really simple favor, right? So the more that you're willing to it takes vulnerability to make a request, right? But when you do that, particularly if you ask for something the other person can easily say yes to, that increases the likelihood that they will do things for you in the future, right? So that's not to be manipulative, but that's to say, listen, you know, don't underestimate the willingness of others to help you out if they can. And if they can, it just only increases the chances that they'll do it going forward in the future, which I think is a huge insight that a lot of people could really benefit from.
I'm in agreement. I think that's a wonderful insight. And even to go back to the word manipulate for a second, again, my bias, I feel like manipulate in and of itself is a neutral word. We manipulate each other all day long as human beings, with our families, with our friends. We do it all day long. So it really comes down to, are we manipulating people with the proper intentions, with the proper techniques towards something that is honestly beneficial? Or are we using these immoral techniques? Are we tricking people? Are we coercing people towards something that's harmful for them? That's really where the delineation between, I guess you could say, positive or negative manipulation comes in. But even I would assume, to get back to like behaviors and how leaders show up, it's likely safe to assume that we're going to have a difficult conversation with everybody, and we're going to need everybody's help at some point. So if we can begin to build that trust you referenced over time and lead by example, as you talked about, over time, by helping where we can and asking them to help where they can, now we're building the relationship equity that social, what was the word that you used?
Social capital.
Thank you. Social capital. That's at least twice I've embarrassed myself in this conversation. The social capital necessary in order to execute at those stressful, high-paced, high-impact times.
No, I think that's exactly right. Right, when you build that, and then when you need it, right, you can draw on it. And again, if someone helps you out, then it makes them more likely to help you out in the future. And then the other thing I would say is, in Maya Angelou, that the author, has a great quote. Like, people, and I'm going to screw it up, but basically, people forget what you say, right? They're not going to forget how you make them feel. And so when you have those opportunities, right, to really think about how do you want to make the other person feel through that process? Because that's what they're going to hold on to. And that's how they're going to remember you. Oftentimes we're thinking, hey, I got to get this point across. Like, what am I going to say? How am I going to convince them? Right. And it's not to say that, you shouldn't be, logical in what you want to share. Right. But don't lose sight of the feelings that you're engendering in others, because that's what's going to stick with them over time.
Amen. So we've talked a little bit about you largely have talked about the shapes of our networks, the positions in our networks, how the structure being tight-knit, but also having access to people outside for the innovative ideas and fresh perspectives in those things as well. But if I recall correctly, during our conversation, you also talked about some different ways that we can leverage our networks and different ways that networks can benefit us outside of what I would think is the traditional, hey, I got a guy for that. So what are some of those other ways that not only our networks can benefit from us, but reciprocally, we can benefit our networks as well?
Sure. So we talked about a couple already, right? One is, your ability to influence, right? That is, a huge one, right? That's one way you can apply your network. Another we talked about was innovation, right? Your ability to come up with new ideas. Right. All the research shows that, your position in the network, when you're that broker role between people with two different domains of expertise, that you can combine that and come up with new stuff. Other ways. So one, coming out of the pandemic, I'm sure, you saw all the articles about one of the things that helps you be more resilient and helps you deal with adversity is, your network, right? We run groups we bring leaders together. We call them peer learning circles, and these are leaders who might be part of the same organization, but they don't work with each other that frequently. And so we bring them together, and their ability to, I think, just by realizing that they're not the only one that has these same challenges. Like, I'm not the only one who has difficulty telling my boss that, they're wrong, or I'm not the only one who has difficulty telling an employee that, their performance isn't where it needs to be, or what are convincing a peer to, like, get on board with my agenda, right? Just by realizing they're not the only one that have these challenges makes folks feel a ton better, right? So in addition to, like, the ideas they get through that network, it makes them better able to handle adversity and uncertainty when they feel like that they're not in it on their own. So I think resilience is a huge benefit that comes with our network. I think another one is really around, force multiplication, right? Like, we started this conversation by talking about, you know, leaders need to, you know, how do leaders go about empowering, right? And so when you've got a network that you can, particularly like you've got a network of folks who, you know, maybe work for you or you're directing their work, right? If those are strong, positive relationships, you're really amplifying your impact, right? Because you can delegate to those folks. You can, you know, provide them with objective feedback and development opportunities, which is strengthening their capabilities. And that's making you just far more impactful across the organization, right? So I think that ability to sort of force multiply, as well as, you know, when you've got a really strong network, you're developing yourself, right? You're getting access to, hey, this is different ways to think about things, right? What are new potential opportunities whether it's new jobs or new projects or whatever, right? So you're being exposed to all sorts of new opportunities that you can step into. So I think, you know, your own career development, top of the force multiplication, your own career development, I think is a critical piece. And you're sort of getting when you've got a really diverse network of, you know, different people at different parts of the organization, different levels, different functions, it gives you a great strategic perspective of like what the heck is going on across this enterprise, right? It's not just you and your own silo, right? You're now able to sort of understand the point of view of people in marketing and finance and R&D, right? And so now, like, oh, okay, I see how all these pieces fit together, right? So I think your network provides you, you know, all those things. It's innovation, it's influence, it's force multiplication, it's resilience, it's career development, it's like strategic perspective, are ways that it really can benefit you. And so that's what explains why it's so impactful, right?
It does. And listening to you go through it a little bit differently, but now twice in a relatively short span of time, month or so, whatever it's been, it really forces me to rethink how I approach my network, because at different points I might be in different positions and it might have different shapes, and that can change from organization to relationship to context, but there's power and opportunity within all of it. And I really appreciate you sharing that. And one of the things I forgot to highlight earlier was I love that you said, shift your focus from what to say to what to ask, and especially the power of follow-up questions. I think that is enormous, and people can get so much more value as leaders, as we started the conversation with, in building their network, where we're kind of wrapping it up now, just with that mindset shift alone. I love that.
Thank you. I think it is it was a valuable lesson that I learned, where I used to think if I did a really good job that people would like me. And then it was through a colleague that I learned that actually it's how you make them feel will determine whether or not they want to work with you, and whether or not they like you, not just, you know, what you bring to the table in terms of expertise. The one other thing I definitely want to share is, though, that what I don't want to suggest is that, you know, you need to have a gazillion contacts, right? There are people who are blessed with, and you and I had the pleasure of talking to one gentleman at the session who was in this position, who, you know, had do that really well, but that doesn't need to be the case. And in fact, every relationship you have takes time and energy to maintain. And so you can get to a place where you've got too many, right? And so you need to be choiceful about the shape of your network, right? And you know, really the research shows that you can only have like maybe 12 to 18 really sort of strong reciprocal relationships that you sort of regularly kind of call on, right? And so if you've got fewer than that, yeah, there might be an opportunity for you to expand your network. But if you've got more than that, then it's going to be tough to manage. And so thinking about, you know, what being choiceful about the shape of your network based on the situation, like, you know, what you're trying to achieve, I think is, as you pointed out, Michael, I think is a really good advice.
And that perfectly ties in many of the thoughts and themes that we've covered today. So thank you for sharing that. Before we wrap up, I want to make sure you've got the opportunity to point people in your direction. For people who have listened to this conversation, they want to learn more from your book, they want to learn more from your organization, they want to connect with you personally, where should they go? Where should they look? How can they connect with you?
Sure. Thank you. So the book is, again, The End of Leadership as We Know It, you know, on sale at your favorite bookseller, right? You know, I encourage people to take a look at that. And then our website is contemporaryleadershipadvisors.com, CLAadvisors.com. Please go there. You can learn more about the work that we do. You know, I'm one of, you know, many people at that firm who, we're all fantastic, and we're happy to support, help in any way we can.
And I'll make sure to have all of those links in the show notes so people don't have to go hunting for them.
Yes.
They can find your book in your website directly there. No problem at all. It is great to see you again. Thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation. I appreciate all of the detail that you shared. I just saw you, and here I am taking notes throughout this whole conversation. So I really appreciate it all, and I look forward to staying in touch as we move forward. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Michael. I really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Take care. We'll talk to you soon. Steve, thank you so much for a great conversation and diving into not only the depth of your research and experiences, but why it's important and how we can all apply it as well. I truly appreciate it. I loved how you talked about the importance of recognizing we don't have all the answers. That's so true. We rarely, if ever, do. I appreciate you sharing that. I also loved how you talked about the difference in the importance of evolving from strategic planning to strategic doing. That was a wonderful idea. I also, in my bias, really love shifting from thinking, what should I say, to what should I ask? That was great. And then to bring it all full circle with the power of saying, I don't know, and how that can unlock the truth in so many leadership scenarios where people generally might be too fearful to be open and honest with us. What a great conversation, Steve. Thank you so much for being here today. And of course, thank you to all of you who took the time to listen and hopefully take notes right alongside me and begin to determine how to apply these ideas to you and your business and all of your high-value personal conversations as well moving forward. Before we check out for today, let's thank our sponsors one more time. HumanTel, please head over to humantel.com. That is where you can take the training to begin to develop the skill set to understand what people are thinking and feeling at any moment in time by recognizing emotional shifts through changes in facial expressions and nonverbal communication. Read their research, check out the science, choose the training that's best for you, and enter the code INCLUSIVE25 for 25% off the training of your choice. I've done it myself. I highly recommend it. HumanTel.com is the place to go. For the professional interviewers, CertifiedInterviewer.com is the place to go. That's where you can learn more about the International Association of Interviewers, what it takes to become a member, the online and in-person educational opportunities, the interviewer resources, the networking opportunities, and so much more. That is also where you can get your questions answered about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. Who qualifies? What's involved in the exam? How do you pass the exam and prepare for the exam? Once you do, what does it mean for you and your career moving forward? All those questions and more answered at CertifiedInterviewer.com. And while you're online, we appreciate you checking out Inclusive.com as well. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to facilitate for their senior leaders, their sales teams, their HR teams, and more to teach them how to apply the persuasive communication and strategic observation skills necessary to obtain the everyday confessions that unlock hidden value in our relationships and business initiatives. All that and more at Inclusive.com. Thank you all so much for continuing to be here week after week. Please, before you go, like the show, comment on the show, leave a review, share the show, let your friends know about it, give us your feedback. We would love to hear it. Thank you for coming back week after week. Please take care of yourselves, stay safe, and we'll see you soon.